Brian Lehrer, WNYC. And remember, our latest crowdsourcing or group journalism project is underway. It's called Are You Being Gouged? We're looking to see what stores and what neighborhoods have the best and worst prices for common items that people eat and drink. Go to your local grocery store and just write down the prices of these three items. Will you do this? You don't have to buy them. Milk, lettuce, and beer. Specifically, a quart of regular whole milk, non-organic, a head of iceberg lettuce, and a six-pack of 12-ounce bottles of Budweiser. Then post the prices and the store's location on our website at WNYC.org. We picked standard things and a brand name just to make a comparison standard across the board. Again, a quart of regular whole milk, non-organic, a head of iceberg lettuce, and a six-pack of 12-ounce bottles of Bud. Then post the prices and the store's location on our website at WNYC.org, and we'll figure out, are you being gouged? Now, if you've already posted your prices and are willing to go one step further, we'll ask you to go to another nearby neighborhood and check the prices there. We'll probably have details on that tomorrow. But if you want to read more about Are You Being Gouged, go to WNYC.org or just go to the store and get us those price points. Well, Senator John McCain, as I said, sat for an interview with me at his publisher's office in Midtown yesterday. He has a new book called Hard Call, Great Decisions and the Extraordinary People Who Made Them. It's published by 12 Books, an interesting imprint that only releases 12 books a year. We talked some about the book and mostly about his presidential campaign. We already played the part about his skipping the PBS debate tonight. Here is most of the interview now. I began by asking him why he thinks he would make the best president for New York.
Because I would keep New York safe, and I believe that I'm capable of preventing another terrorist attack on America, but most importantly, I am most qualified to lead in the transcendent issue of the 21st century, which is the challenge of radical Islamic extremism.
You know, our former mayor, very well known here, mm-hmm. says the exact same thing. Why do you think you can beat Rudy Giuliani in his own backyard on the issue of terrorism?
It's not the issue of terrorism. It's the struggle against radical Islamic extremism, which is going to be a long twilight struggle. This is a force of evil that's been unleashed in the world. And I'm a great admirer of Mayor Giuliani's. I believe that my life, my experience, my knowledge and background give me the qualifications that might lend me to their consideration.
Better than him, why? Can you say?
The qualifications, simply qualifications, my background, my knowledge. I can give you one example, and that is that I was the only one who's running for president, and I don't like to compare myself to anyone specifically, but railed against the Rumsfeld strategy, which failed, and I predict it was going to fail, and I fought for the strategy that is now succeeding. No one else running for president argued that because, frankly, they don't have the military and national security credentials that I do, and I think they're all fine people. Question is, who can lead the country in this struggle?
When I search John McCain on YouTube, the biggest thing that comes up is you singing Bomb, 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 Iran. 744,000 hits, in case you haven't checked it recently. Are you proud or embarrassed of that?
I'm proud. Look, when I'm in the company of veterans, which I was, and one of them says to me, when are you going to send a message to Iran? And we're joking around. I'm going to joke around. And if someone doesn't like it, my advice to them is to lighten up. I've articulated my position on Iran many times and what needs to be done. But if someone, like when I had to tell a high school student the other day that he was a little jerk, if that offends them and they don't like it, that's too bad. My response is lighten up. You can know my position on Iran, which is very, very in-depth as to what we need to do.
Mayor Giuliani is stating quite directly, you probably heard it the other day, that he would bomb Iran if necessary to stop a nuclear weapons program. Do you want to make that same direct statement in that way, or is that too bellicose?
The way I want to say it is what I've said. There's only one thing worse than a situation of a nuclear... Let me put it that way. Let me take three. My My response is, we cannot allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Having said that, there's many actions that we can take between now and reaching that point that would, I think, have a beneficial effect on the Iranian policy.
Do you think Mayor Giuliani was being counterproductive by putting it the way he did?
I don't know. I'd leave that to others to judge.
When Ahmadinejad spoke at Columbia University, he said a lot of wacky things not worthy of debate, but he also questioned why the rules for nuclear weapons allow the United States to keep developing new generations of nukes. He said we're on our fifth, despite America's record and all of that, and Iran gets to develop none. Does he have a point on this one with respect to the United States?
I don't think he has a point, because the real point is that we're not dedicated to the extinction of any country. He has announced his nation's dedication to the extinction of the State of Israel. He, as we speak, is attempting to destabilize and exert an age-old Persian ambition of influence in Iraq. They are supporting terrorist organizations throughout the Middle East and the world. So I think there's a dramatically different situation.
He would say, and not just Ahmadinejad would say, that the United States has a history destabilizing Iran, that we took part in the overthrow of Mossadegh in the 1950s, that we engaged with Saddam Hussein in his war of aggression against Iran in the 1980s. That's not a good advertisement for the United States.
No, and this is the same country that held Americans hostage for over 400 days. This is the country that, as you say, engaged in a war with Iraq. I know that there have been mistakes in the conduct of American national security policy, but to compare us in any way with what Iran's ambitions are and what they are doing, I think are just not comparable.
Mitt Romney has an ad this week boasting that, you know, forget about Ahmadinejad. Romney denied a police escort to the former president, Khatami, when he visited Massachusetts. Now, Khatami was the relative moderate who wanted to reach out to the United States. Did Romney show good judgment there?
Again, I don't know anything about the incident, so it's hard for me to make that kind of judgment. I'm not sure that police escort or lack of police escort has a very permanent effect on anything.
But dismissing Khatami as if he was Ahmadinejad, when he was certainly was not, you know, an American or a pro-American per se, but he was relative moderate. Is that counterproductive?
I can't make that kind of judgment. I didn't even know he did it. I was doing other things at the time.
Your book explores the making of important historic decisions in war and peace, in business, in literature. Let's go down some of them. You include Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev's decision to make their historic nuclear treaty. What's important there?
The importance is that at one point, Ronald Reagan was offered a deal by Gorbachev that seemed like a very good deal, a dramatic dismantling of both of the nuclear inventories and return for giving up of the Strategic Defense Initiative. Every advisor of Ronald Reagan said, take the deal. He said no. It turned out to be one of the wisest decisions that he made, because Gorbachev then believed that there's no way that his military buildup could ever overcome ours. It was a historic decision and a very hard call.
How does that inform what kind of president you might be? Do you imagine yourself in a similar potential breakthrough with any world leader?
Absolutely. And I believe that that one of my first priorities would be the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. We'll probably discuss, and when you know well known my views on the war in Iraq, but I don't think there's ever going to be genuine peace in the Middle East until we have a Palestinian-Israeli peace settlement that's enforceable and fair.
So what has to change to get to yes on that? So many people have tried.
I think maybe because of the disarray and the difficulties in the Middle East today, it may create an environment that could lead to a settlement. I would find the smartest people I know to go over there. I would tell everybody that it's America's really a national security priority, and I think that that we would have a chance to succeed. And if even if we didn't, you've got to stay at it. Sooner or later, all things in. The Northern Ireland peace process finally bore fruit after, and there were times when I promise you I didn't think they would ever settle.
But that would be the United States as an honest broker in somebody else's dispute. Can you see any parallel to what Reagan did? And he got criticized from the right when he made that deal with Gorbachev. Obviously, you can't come to this kind of negotiated agreement with Al-Qaeda. So is there anything else that could be a parallel in today's world?
Again, I think the Northern Ireland situation is an example where economic development as well as political maturation played a significant role. 15 years ago, I was in Belfast, and there was 90% unemployment, and people were killing each other regularly. And now we see about 90% employment. I think Bosnia is an example where we came in, stopped genocide with sufficient force, and now the parties are at least moving forward at a snail's pace, but towards political reconciliation. So I think there are examples where we can succeed with a combination of diplomatic, economic, and at sometimes military intervention. If the British Army hadn't been in Northern Ireland, there never would have been an environment that created a negotiating atmosphere.
You explore in the book the philosopher Reinhold Niebuhr's decision to abandon his pacifist stance before World War II. The importance?
Well, there's a lot of importance. It's probably the most complex part of our book. Reinhold Niebuhr was a pacifist, but he began to believe that in the face of an overwhelming evil, in this case Nazi Germany, that it required that they act, that he act. And at the same time, he knew that he then was going counter to his Christian pacifist principles, and his conclusion was that we are all imperfect and have to place ourselves at the mercy of a loving God when it's time for us to be judged. He went through a very interesting process.
Pick any other one of your choice.
Probably Abraham Lincoln and emancipation, also Branch Rickey in bringing Jackie Robinson into organized baseball. Both were acts of courage. Both of them were acts that were based on a belief greater than themselves. And it sounds kind of trivial to put Branch Rickey in the same category of Abraham Lincoln, but the principle applies. In the case of Abraham Lincoln, he became more religious as this carnage of the Civil War went on. And he really felt he owed it an obligation to free the slaves if they could show some success on the Union side. Difficult decision for him to make, and one that I think changed the course of history in many respects. Branch Rickey was a kind of a blowhard. The reporters called it the Cave of the Winds when they talked to him. But what he did wasn't just baseball. It was about America. It was about what kind of country America is. And I think it had a profound effect on American society. We've still got a long way to go, but I think it had a far greater effect than just on baseball.
When you look at the many stories in this book, and it's interesting that it's not just called Great Leadership, it's called Hard Call, Great Decisions and the Extraordinary People Who Made Them. Does something tie together some of the many hard calls that people had to make?
I think what ties them together at the end of the day, whether they had time to take in consideration all the factors and weigh and assess, at the end of the day is whether it was an act that entailed a benefit or an act of goodness and decency that was greater than the self-interest of the individual. And it is my belief, and it's been my theme in this book and others, that to serve a cause greater than yourself is the noblest of all pursuits, and frankly, it's the most rewarding.
I mentioned your presence on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Do you think YouTube is good for democracy?
Sure. I think YouTube is good for democracy, and I think we will mature and recognize that maybe sometimes politicians do make mistakes and do things that are a little bit stupid, but people deserve to know about them, and that's and I think it's a good thing. Just like I think that John Stewart is a good thing, even though he makes fun of me all the time.
I think you're the most frequent of all his guests, aren't you?
And the frequent of his most frequent of his guests, which means there must be a trace of masochism. Must be a trace of masochism somewhere in my family.
Did you ever go to comedy school?
No, I never did. But humor is important. Humor is important in politics. We've had some who are natural at it. Reagan was pretty good at humor, and some others. But I think it's important for us to try to use humor as much as possible, even though it's a very dangerous enterprise.
David Brooks wrote yesterday in his New York Times column, or earlier this week, that the future of the Democratic Party is not online, despite what the Netroots people would like us to believe. What do you think about that with respect to the Democrats or the Republicans? Is the web changing democracy, or does it just have that appearance?
I'm a great admirer of David Brooks, but I think that the internet, I think websites, I think YouTube, that I think that what way they're, quote, changing is they're providing people with more information. Therefore, I think they make more better judgments. And so I think it's a good thing. It is more evolutionary than perhaps that some think, but it is... Any time Americans get more information, then I have greater confidence in their judgment. That's what all this has done for them.
I don't know if you've thought about this, but some people say the web divides people even more into political camps than we already have been because they go to websites with like-minded people.
I think it's probably true, but most Americans, I think, particularly young ones, go to all the websites. They also want to be entertained, and I understand that. But I'm not worried so much about what happens in the websites and the polarization. I worry more about we in Washington doing our duty, that stopping the corruption, cleaning up the spending, taking on the hard issues. Look, Social Security is going to go broke. We all know it. What have we done about it lately? We're going to hand it on to another generation. What about Medicare? What about, in other words, Americans are dissatisfied with us, not because they know more about us because of the internet, but because they see that we aren't doing what we were sent to do.
You've been active in media policy in the Congress. Do you have a position on net neutrality?
I think that net neutrality is something that we have to look at from time to time, but I don't want to see the wealthiest and most powerful entrant into the internet crowd out the independence, which really is what given it's its strength and vitality. It's a very tough issue. But by the way, it's one that's not tough, internet taxes. We've got to extend permanently, in my view, the internet tax moratorium.
I wonder about campaign advertising and election law on the web. You're obviously interested in campaign finance. Mm-hmm. McCain-Feingold. Some people think Fred Thompson got a free ride in the way he was able to spend money on the web this summer before declaring as a candidate.
I would not support campaign finance laws imposed on the web. It's still a young and very immature technology, and I don't think that McCain-Feingold applies.
Why not? Wouldn't that make the web, which is becoming our dominant medium, a gigantic campaign finance loophole?
I think the gigantic finance loophole right now is the 527s and their advertising on television.
The independent interest groups, everything from MoveOn.org to the National Rifle Association, things like that?
Yes, and I think it's a gigantic loophole that's there already.
The Supreme Court weakened McCain-Feingold. Yep. Is there anything left of it that matters?
They only weakened one part of it. I think you're going to see a lot more, quote, issue ads as the election nears. But the major achievement of that law was to stop the soft money, which we know corrupted Washington. We have former members of Congress in federal prison. It stopped the ability of a union leader, a trial lawyer, a corporate head from being called by a member of Congress and say, I need a seven-figure check from you. That stopped. I need a seven-figure check from you, and your bill is up before my committee next week. That's been stopped, and I think that's been very beneficial.
You know, I thought I read somewhere that you were against net neutrality legislation on the grounds that the market would provide. Do I have that wrong?
Look, I go back and forth on this issue, and I think I understand the requirement that we not have anybody have an advantage, and then there's other times. I haven't really taken a firm and hard position on it, and that's one of the few that I haven't. I continue to look at it. It's a very tough issue.
When the war was in its early stages, if I remember correctly, you were calling for much more than 130,000 or 160,000 troops in order to do the job properly. Can we do it now with 130,000, or is that just a formula for a quagmire?
I believe General Petraeus when he tells me that he has sufficient number of troops. Am I nervous about it? Of course. But I think there's some realities, and that is the overall size of the Army and Marine Corps, which are significant constraints, and we have put a burden on the National Guard and the Reserves that is something that we've never asked of the Guard and Reserve before.
You've been outspoken about the importance of national service in the past. Do you think we now need to reconsider a military draft in a time of war and with expanded need, as you just described?
I do not believe we need or would find useful a draft. The training required for young men and women today in the military is extensive. The military that we have today, by all accounts, is the most professional, the best equipped, the best trained, and the most effective. So why would we want to destroy that? What I think we need to do is build on it. And finally, you know, we might say we're going to have a draft that's fair to everybody, but we never have. We never have. And so I have no confidence that wealthy people would find a way out of the draft, and we would ask the lowest economic rung on our ladder to serve.
Why think that 130,000, 160,000 can do it? A lot of people aren't going to be satisfied with the answer that you have trust in David Petraeus, because even if he's the best general on the planet, he can only work with the tools that he has.
Well, he can, but he also assured me that if he thought he needed more, he would tell the president and the American people. I'm aware of everything that goes on in Iraq, or a lot that goes on in Iraq, but I'm not the on-the-ground commander. He is, and I have to rely on his judgment. And his judgment so far has been very good. We are achieving significant success on the military front. Even the severest critic, or most of the severest critics of the war, would agree with that.
Did President Bush miss an opportunity at the UN this week to ask for international help on Iraq? He talked about the horrors of Myanmar and Zimbabwe, but pretty much evaded Iraq. And it looked to me like he was using Myanmar to change the subject. And for that matter, the UN has seemed to offer more international involvement. And this is what Iraq needs, isn't it?
My enduring hero is Aung San Suu Kyi. I have admired her more than anyone alive on this planet today.
The Burmese human rights activist.
The elected leader of Burma, who has been under house arrest 12 of the last 15 years, whose husband died away from her. But I think it's very appropriate the president talk about Burma, they call it Myanmar, because we are at a critical point here, and the more pressure we can put on that military junta, the better off.
He could have done both.
I was just going to add, I think that I probably would have praised the Secretary General of the UN, who just announced that they would have a renewed UN presence, and I, of course, would have made an appeal. Now, I can't second-guess the president on every speech he makes, and maybe he felt it would dilute the message of that he wanted to give. There are other venues where he's asked for more international assistance.
Make that appeal. How would you have made it?
My friends, we are beginning to succeed in Iraq. Here are the consequences of failure. Listen to the president of Iran, who recently said, when the U.S. leaves Iraq, there will be a void and we will fill it. We need your participation. If we're going to have genuine, lasting peace in the region, We need every country, particularly those who are our allies, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Saudis, and others, to join with us and help bring about or maintain a peaceful environment now that we have sacrificed so much American blood and treasure to obtain a peaceful, an environment of largely secure areas of Iraq with a long way to go.
Every candidate is positioning him or herself in some way for the race. For you, one way you get charged with a flip-flop is your opposition to the Bush tax cuts originally and your embrace of making them permanent. Can you square that, or is that for consumption in the Republican primaries?
I had tax cuts of my own. I objected to the Bush tax cuts because I saw a war coming, but most importantly, there was no restraint on spending. My proposal for tax cuts was that we would have a restraint on spending. If that had been enacted today, I think Republicans would still be in a majority, and we'd be talking about further tax cuts. I am convinced that if you now don't make the tax cuts permanent, then it has the effect of a tax increase on every family, business, and individual in America. So, of course, I don't want to do something that would have the effect of a tax increase.
We're here in New York, where we went 75% for Gore and Kerry in New York City. Many of my listeners are thinking, hasn't Bush been a terrible president? A bad war, badly managed at very least, tax cuts that were badly designed at very least, by your description, divisive as can be at home and abroad at a time when we need unity. Hasn't he been a terrible president?
I think the judgment of history about President Bush will be largely related to whether we succeed or fail in Iraq, and that's not clear yet. We've also had one of the strongest economic periods of prosperity in our history. We've also created millions of jobs. There's a lot of, we have not had another attack on the United States since 9/11, when every expert in New York City believed there would be another one, but between now and that period. So historians judge presidents largely on foreign policy / national security issues, and the results are not in. I happen to like the president. We have a good working relationship, and clearly I would not have conducted the first 4 years of the war in Iraq under Rumsfeld, and that, in my view, may earn a very harsh criticism from historians.
We have a minute left. You seem to do well as the underdog. People liked you in that role in 2000. Now that you have hit a kind of political bottom, perhaps people are starting to talk about you again in more positive terms. Is that what it takes for John McCain to be politically surging and make your one last case to New Yorkers that they should consider John McCain on February 5th?
First of all, we've had ups and downs in every campaign, and we certainly have had them in this one. I'm confident now that Labor Day is well over, people start in New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Iowa start focusing on the candidates. I can out-campaign anybody. The town hall meeting, the retail politics, we don't need a lot of money. I'm confident that I will do well. I'm the most fortunate American or person you have ever interviewed, and I'm grateful for the life I have. We're going to outwork everybody, and we're going to do fine. And to New Yorkers, I would like for you to know that this city is unique in the world. I intend to do everything I can to be of assistance to make it even greater and build on the successes of their former mayors. And this mayor is one of the great ones, I think, in Michael Bloomberg.
Take me there one level deeper. How is New York unique in the world and great, and how would your policies make it greater?
It's unique in the world in that the financial, cultural, and many other ways, it is the center of our universe. It has the most diverse background, where we've mixed the blood of the world into making it the most vital and vibrant society in America. It has an incredible impact on the world in every possible way, whether it be art or whether it be finances or whether it be culture. And the people of New York are the most sophisticated and cosmopolitan. And so And I believe that many citizens of New York City, whether they be Democrat or Republican, will examine the candidates, because we are in very difficult times, not only here in the United States, but in the world.
McCain-Bloomberg or Bloomberg-McCain in 08 if you don't get the nomination?
I don't think so. I think that I am the party of Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, and I wouldn't want to leave it.
Senator McCain, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you again.
We recorded that interview with Senator McCain yesterday at the offices of his publisher, 12 Books. We thank them for the space. His new book is called Hard Call. And coming up, we have an important development in the last few minutes on a story from the front page of the New York Times today. Verizon has decided to reverse its policy that prevented people from getting text messages that they had requested from NARAL, the abortion rights group. We'll explain in a minute.